Day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
And good afternoon. It's a few seconds after 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon. From 4 to 6 o'clock, we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today in this first and well into the second hour, it's the 10th and actually final installment of recordings I did at last fall's Kingston Writers Fest. And from this event called Inside Story, you'll hear Ann Collins in conversation with Marilyn Simons. This roughly 90-minute conversation and reading will run uninterrupted into and over halfway through the second hour. I won't interrupt. And in the bit of time that remains following the event in the second hour, you'll hear me share, a bit of information about quickly approaching calls for submissions, their deadlines, upcoming events, and a bit of other information. Just my usual start of the hour announcement is occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show. May contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. Second announcement, which I usually do at the end of each hour, is I won't get the chance to do that because this segment will run through that, and I won't interrupt just to say this, but I just want to let you know that every show is saved to my personal blog space for it. I do upload that about an hour after I get after the show ends. Once I get home, it is and that space is Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com. That is my personal blog space for the show. It will remain there for 3 years. Again, I usually try to get that done about 7 o'clock, so about an hour after the show airs after I get home. Tell you what, here we go. And here again, just reintroducing, in case you happen to tune in a minute or so late, reintroducing what you'll hear, because you won't hear my voice again for quite a while, you're going to hear the first and well into the second hour in the 10th and my final installment of the recordings from last year's Kingston Writers Fest program and sessions there. And from it, you'll hear an event called Inside Story, which was a conversation between Ann Collins and Marilyn Simons. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, and just so you know, this roughly 90-minute conversation and reading, there was no reading, conversation will run uninterrupted into and over halfway through the second hour. And sort of as a mini intro to it, the Writers Fest every year also puts out a program guide and has a short synopsis or a little blurb about what to expect at each of the sessions. And so I'm going to read that, and then that'll kind of introduce us into it, and then I'll just go straight into that recording. So what they said in their program guide was, again, Inside Story. Stories abound of iconic editors who wrestled shaggy manuscripts into sleek, best-selling books. Ann Collins, executive editor at Random House Canada, is among them. It says, join Collins for a frank and freewheeling discussion of the progress of a book from manuscript to bookstore shelves, laced with stories of great books past, present, and future. And again, this is Ann Collins in conversation with Marilyn Simons, which took place September 21st last year. And to tell you what, without further ado, let me find my mouse here. Here we go. And here you go.
Good morning. Welcome to Edison Writers Fest. My name is Holly Whitney, and as a member of the festival committee, I'm very pleased to introduce event number 11, Inside Story, with Ann Collins. Please note our late acknowledgement on the screen in the foyer. We honor the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples who lived here before us and still call it home, and are grateful for the opportunity to share this space that is so rich in history, language, and storytelling. In a moment, Alla and Jace introduce our moderator, but first a few words about the event itself. It'll last for approximately an hour and a half, which includes a short Q&A at the end. Please come to the mic, which will be placed at the center of the aisle to ask your questions. If you have mobility concerns, just raise your hand and one of our lovely ushers will come to you with a mic. I now draw your attention to the PEN Canada empty chair. As we gather to celebrate our freedom to write and to read, this vacant chair symbolizes the absence of a writer whose defense of these freedoms has led to their persecution and imprisonment. You'll find more information on the PEN Canada website. And now some thank yous. Kingston Writers Fest would like to thank the author patrons of this event, Joanne LaChapelle-Bayek, author patron of Ann Collins, and Christine Everdell of Tummy Tots Occupational Therapy, author patron of Marilyn Simons. We are also grateful to the City of Kingston Arts Fund, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Canada Council for the Arts, as well as the many institutions, businesses, and individuals who support the festival, and of course, all the dedicated volunteers that work long hours for the love of books. To you all. And now our usual housekeeping details. Please mute any devices that might ring or beep during this talk, and please refrain from taking pictures or recording the event. We have our festival photographer who will be posting photographs daily on our Kingston Writers Fest website. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Marilyn Simons. Marilyn Simons has written about birds. Sorry. I'll introduce you. Marilyn has written about birds, gardens, food, travel, the nature of bookmaking, and female friendship. She has written short fiction, 3 actual novels, several memoirs, and 2 biographies. Her methods of publication have been just as varied. Her books have been published in digitally and conventional print, as well as produced on a 19th century printing press. Later this afternoon, I hope you can join me and a lot of our volunteers to hear all about her latest book, Walking with Beth, which was edited by Ann Collins. A recent review called it a deeply considered meditation on friendship, aging, and mortality, and the meaning we build between ourselves and others over time. Please join me in welcoming Marilyn Simons.
Thank you, Holly. We're all a little punchy this morning. This is day 4. Holly, just to tell you who that person was, Holly, along with homeschooling 4 kids, working a farm, and maintaining a practice as a naturopathic doctor, Holly is our volunteer coordinator and involved with and overseeing, in fact, the finding, the training, the scheduling, and managing of our 80 to 100 volunteers. Ooh. So she is. dress is great too. So full disclosure, as she said, Anne was my editor on this new book. And also, Anne was my very, very first editor in the, I didn't look up the date. But
let's not.
Okay, let's not. But it would be in the early to mid 80s when I published my first story in a magazine. And Anne acquired it and edited it. And so, you know, this is a great book and I should probably die now. But, you know, all of that relationship is not the only reason why I'm about to say some very nice things about her. Anne herself is an accomplished writer. She won the 1988 Governor General's Award for her book In the Sleep Room about CIA brainwashing experiments at the Allen Institute in Toronto. For those of us just starting out at that time, and I was among those, her use of story techniques to shape nonfiction material were absolutely a revolution, and an inspiration. Eventually she stepped away from writing into publishing, which is something I intend to ask her about. And she spent 23 years as the publisher of Random House Canada. Part of that time she was head honcho at Knopf Canada. She's worked with an amazing array of international superstars, including Julian Barnes, Robert McFarlane, Richard Powers, here in Canada, Romeo Dallaire, Michelle Good, Eden Robinson, Chris Hadfield, Linda McIntyre, Julian, Brave Noise Cat, Ian Williams. So she has several of her authors here at the festival. And in 2019, she received the Ivy Award for an extraordinary contribution to publishing in Canada, very well deserved. And I just want to be clear, this is not the Anne Collins who starred in the movie Wonder Woman. Although she could have.
No.
In my books, she is a Wonder Woman. So, for 20 years you worked as a writer and a magazine editor. Why the switch to books?
Oh, the short answer is that I got really tired of stories that were only 6 to 10,000 words long.
Right.
I had been an incredible, I really loved my journalism career. I really loved at the time the things that we find out that are find outable in 3 to 6 months. But I had sort of I had made the mistake. I was out for dinner with my husband. I was editing the whole feature island at Toronto Life at the time, and we were doing really good work, and I really liked it on one level, but on another level I was really bored. And I actually said that to my husband at dinner one night, and the next morning I got a call from a fellow named David Kent who asked me if I had any desire at all to come over and run Random House Canada. And
okay.
I just said, you know, I know nothing. I've been editing in magazines in which I don't have to pay any attention to whether the magazine sells. That's the job of the publisher.
Right.
I don't have to sell the content of the magazine. I just have to make sure it fits what a magazine does. And book publishing is almost the first thing you have to think about with a book is who can you sell it to? Especially when the job I was being offered was for a multinational. There were no government grants. I couldn't do anything just because it needed doing. I had to do something that actually both I felt made a contribution, but also we needed to be able to sell it.
Yeah.
So I said yes, because how could you not say yes? And then I don't think I had a day off for the first 6 months I was working in publishing, which was a sign of things to come.
Yeah.
It was a sign of things to come. Yeah, I was hired on I started on June 15th, 1998, and I think maybe I had a day off at Christmas. Yeah,
wow.
It was crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you're still really, I mean, the life of an editor is really,
yeah,
really busy. I mean, at that point, you were publisher.
I was running the imprint, but because I didn't have any track record in book publishing, the agents didn't know me. They knew me a little bit because some of their writers I've worked with. The only thing I had to offer to publishing was the fact that I had relationships with a lot of major nonfiction writers, some fiction writers in Canada. So building the Random House imprint was using the relationships I had and the skills I had, which were largely editing and making books happen.
Right.
And so, you know, even today I edit a big chunk of the Random House Canada list still, even though I'm not the publisher anymore, just because, well, it's the thing I love to do, but it was also the way I could make a contribution and build a list. Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about that word editing, which is, I think, very misunderstood out there in the world. And maybe the best way to do it is to start at the beginning. So a manuscript arrives on your desk. How does it arrive?
Well, even before the manuscript arrives, if you're in a book publisher, you have to figure out which manuscript it is you want to arrive.
Right.
So,
I mean, do they still come over the transit? Oh, they only come through the...
No, they come. They come through by email.
Oh, I don't mean physically.
No, they come. They come through agents. They come. They also come through your relationships. They come through, you know, people you think are interesting, and you have a conversation and try to figure out if they have a book that you could work with them on. And they come in varieties of ways. When you get to be my vintage, you have a lot of relationships with agents. So you get, like, even now when I'm acquiring much less, I get just tons of submissions all the time. But because I have a track, quite often there are things I can't resist, because people know what I like to do, they know who I like to work with, they know the kind of challenging things I like to take on. And so, yeah, you get a lot. Last week I had 7 in 2 days. So that's 7 things from internationally and from Canada to think about as to whether we could do anything with them.
Right.
Yeah.
And then how is the decision, who makes the decision as to whether or not the manuscript is going to be taken and moved towards publication?
Well, the first line is you have to... Okay, so when you decide to take something on, it's got to be something that, in some level, thrills you, interests you, wakes you up, because you're going to be with it not for 2 minutes or 4 months. You're going to be with it for 2 or 3 years. You're going to read it about 4 or 5 times, and so the first thing that a submission has to spark. It doesn't have to spark that kind of passion in every single person on the team, but somebody has to really, really think that they can go the distance with this, and that it's worth doing, that there's meaning to it, that whether it's a fresh voice, whether it's a piece of fiction that just thrills them, whether it's a piece of nonfiction that just, you know, is so feels so crucial that you're the one that has the skills to do it, you have to. So that's the first layer. But then, the thing that editors do that you probably don't know they do is then they have to pitch inside their company. They have to, you know, you think that the sales force eventually is the one pitching the book. The first line of pitching is the editor trying to get everybody else signed up to their vision of the book, their vision, and that is not only their vision for why the book is great, because basically great writing and thrilling everything doesn't necessarily mean you can sell it. So then you have to figure out where it could go in the market. Sometimes it's as simple as, is there a buyer at Indigo who will be as entranced with this area as you are and will give you enough of an initial order that you can actually print the book? This is how ridiculous it is. It's like, so every book that comes out from a publishing company is like a little economic unit. And when you're going to what is the acquisition board, you create a whole profit and loss statement. You putative, how many it might sell, how many might come back, what are the channels in the market, what retailers you think will do well with them. It's like a huge, then you, now you have, which you didn't, when I first started you could just persuade and faith would carry you along. Now there's data analytics, there's a track. I think the worst thing for an acquiring editor was the invention of something called BookNet Canada, which actually tracks the sales through cash registers, of every book in Canada. And so often you think something is absolutely crucial, that it's the right book for the moment, you've got everybody signed up, and then your sales guy will go look at the track and will say, we'll get 200 out in Indigo based on the track, because they buy on the track. So it's a massive work of persuasion now, even more complicated than it was when I first started. Because when I started, I was a publisher. I really liked it. If I could get my sales lead to really love it, then you were away to the races.
Well, I remember early on, I think actually with The Convict Lover, I remember going in and talking to the salespeople. Like all the salespeople were gathered. And I went in and pitched my book.
Yeah.
Got a new dress.
I have almost got new dresses when I've had to do it.
Yeah, so
put on the lipstick.
So that's really changed now. It's a numbers game now.
It's a lot of it is a numbers game. The passion really still counts, because it's not, you can't actually publish well if people don't really, really, really care.
Right.
But the numbers you can really, really care. I hate having to write rejection letters which say, everybody loves this, but, I have sometimes great submissions from wonderful writers who haven't yet had a hit commercially or in the market. And, I have a whole repertoire of people who didn't sell well until their fifth or sixth book, including Peering Tapes.
Yeah.
So I just, I said, but I can only do that argument so many times before they catch me.
But it does change things.
It changes things enormously.
Because there isn't really...
Yeah.
There's no longer the time for a writer to develop.
Well,
in a way. I mean, they have to develop on their own. And maybe... I mean, what do they do? They publish in magazines and smaller publishers. And
there's not as crap. Clear...
But they don't sell enough copies to register on BookNet.
There's not a clear track that way. I mean, also... when I started, there was also a real ecology of talent finding in the Canadian publishing, where, small presses, quote-unquote Canadian-owned presses, felt like the big publishers felt like that was a talent pool. And when I started, there was a whole distortion of that going on, where there was a lot of money being thrown around for people coming out of small presses or first novels. There was a sort of a bidding war between a wonderful editor named Alan Seligman and a really a huge figure in Canadian publishing, Louise Dennis. They would, between them, bid things up, and it kind of disrupted the whole sort of publishing network. And then a lot of consolidation happened and things like that. Yeah, it's different. It's different now. It's also different now for the writer, in that they have to be far more in charge of a kind of branding exercise around their work, which kind of makes me feel icky, because I can't brand myself to save my soul. And yet we sort of, as publishers, we kind of expect, hope that writers will be willing participants or somewhat savvy in that world. And we don't have right now a media that does the work that the media used to do.
That's for sure.
Covering books.
Yeah.
We have lots of book shows, but they're not talking. They're not telling people why this book is great, or why the book has interesting ideas, or why the book will make they're talking a lot about, the likes and dislikes of the author, or personal stories of the author. The first questionnaire. And, I will not shit on that from a great height, because we take what we can get. But, man, I wish there was still a medium for intelligent conversation about why the book matters.
Mm-hmm.
Why the book will matter to you. There's an ecology around genre that's very lively and thriving around romance, around fantasy, that sort of drives a lot of... But the books that we need about how we're living, how we're feeling, the books that are nuanced, it's harder to find really great conversation about that, except in places like this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So more of this.
Yeah. I agree. So say you've now got this manuscript that somebody on the team absolutely adores. convinces the rest of the team, convinces sales, it's acquired. Mm-hmm. Then what?
Well, then often the writer has to go away and write it, you know, when it's nonfiction.
Yeah. But if it's fiction or if it's a finished manuscript.
What happens then is I view my job as an editor as a kind of combination of sort of intellectual safety net. I spend a lot of my time basically reassuring writers that they can do what they're trying to do, and also kind of a sidekick, almost a sidekick to the process. Like, my job is, when the book is acquired, I forget all about the market. I forget all about even the you know, publication date. My job at that point is to work with a writer to help as best I can them to make the book the best book they can make, the best thing it is. I once got told by a writer who was edited in the States and by me that in the States they edit for the market and I edited for the book. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the most important thing I can do, because there's so many squashing, ameliorating forces to tell people they can't do this, they can't do that, the market, blah, blah, they need a happy ending, blah. My job, my whole job is to be a zone that says, let's make this book the best thing you can make. Let's take you into the area that scares you. Part of my job as an editor, too, is to show a writer what they put on the page in a way that they can trust. So when you're trying to make something from scratch, often you can't even see what you've made, right? You make it, you think of these people 2 or 3 or sometimes 4, some in one case 12 years in a manuscript. By the time you've followed every rabbit hole, you don't know what you've made. But you need somebody who you trust, who feels in sync with you, to show you what you've made and also show you where what you don't need. So it's, people think editors fix sentences. Well, some editors do, but what I tend to do is be in this wonderful zone where somebody's making something and I'm helping. And it's such a privileged zone to be in, because it satisfies, I was a writer, yes, first, but I was a writer because I was super curious. I wasn't a writer who needed to write. I was a writer who was really curious about the world, and writing was my way of being able to ask questions. And now I work with all these people who take on huge chunks of the universe. And either imaginatively, like I've just been working with Eden Robinson, who is a wonderful writer. I worked with her on a book series called The Trickster Trilogy. And she's ventured into this area where she's doing a kind of wild, it's a world building, it's not quite fantasy, but it's set on a terraformed planet where in the far distant past a character somewhat like Elon Musk has decided to make a destination for space tourism, and the destination he's chosen is he's imported, recreated several Pacific Northwest Coast indigenous nations and established them on the planet. And then the space tourism thing fails, the technology fails, and the novel, which is the first of a series, is set in this world where these people have an origin story that's part technology, part tourism, part fake, part whatever, and they're trying to live this life. And so Eden is, we're on the fourth. She had to invent this whole world, right? She had to invent every aspect of it, and then she had to make vivid fiction in it. So there were, I don't know, 4 drafts, I think, where it's just like trying to figure out what the freak the world is, and then how to narrow it down so that there's a story that can be told that doesn't need huge amounts of explanation. So what she needs is not for me to be good on the line level. She needs me to help her show her what she's imagined, what isn't there, what she's assuming, what she, you know, I stand in for the reader, but it's a funny situation because I'm not defending the readers, how do I put this, I'm standing in for the reader, but mostly I'm on the side of the artist trying to make something. And, you know, by the end, we hope the reader will really love it, but we're trying to make it so it just shines. So that's what you do. Like, you're, you know, like, I didn't have to edit you much at all, because you already knew what you were trying to do. But in the end, I try to serve the function of showing you what you've got.
Yeah, and you did. I mean, yeah. There were certain my books made up of a whole bunch of, I think, 90-some wee pieces. And we spent considerable time on
getting
some of them.
And also getting the flow right.
And getting the flow right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we had a big fight over one of them.
Not a big fight.
Not a big fight. It was a little fight. I think writers often feel the fight is big. You know?
Oh yeah. Oh,
even
yeah.
When it's little.
Yeah.
Because one becomes so wedded to both the words, like the phrasing, just the sentence, but also to the concept.
Yeah.
And so there's a section that I don't know how many of you were at the Otonia Kvapitek event, and she has a section in her book called What We Carry. And, you know, many of us were influenced by the book, What They Carried, obviously. And I had a section, I don't know if it was What We Carried, They Carried, I don't even remember what I carried.
Yeah, somebody was carrying something.
Somebody was carrying something. And what it was for me, it is this rather long recitation of what the world was like when Beth was born, growing up, moving through the 30s and the 40s, and then I'm born in the same year that she was married, and then it continues, you know, in the 1950s, Beth, you know, the world was this for Beth, it was this for me, and right up to the present. And I really wanted that to kind of show the rhythm of history and how, you know, I think each generation thinks like, we just grew up in such a rotten time. And I hear it from my kids and from my adult grandchildren that, well, you can't possibly understand because, you know, the world is really different now. But when you look at these cycles, it's not really different. You know, all the invasions and wars and everything. But, you know, and I didn't like it.
No.
You didn't like it at all.
Oh, yeah. I knew you were doing it. I knew you were doing it.
Exactly. But it didn't work, right? Yeah. And so I sort of gnashed my teeth a little bit, and then I thought, well, can I try it again?
Yeah.
Right? And she was right. It went on way too long, and it was way too complicated, and there was repetition, and I think I cut it more than in half, I think almost a third. And it was much better. I mean, yay to Anne for making me see
that's the job.
But it was up to me to fix it. So from the writer's point of view, the editor is there to show you where the flaw is. They can't always, in fact, can rarely tell you how to fix it, but they can tell you that it needs fixing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, I've heard a lot of people sort of mouth the expectation that editors are going to fix it. I've had students say, well, I don't have to fix that, there are editors for that. No, there aren't.
Not when it comes to the conception of the work.
No.
If it's not, yeah, the thing that's so wonderful about working with writers is that, or just working in books, is that you're working with someone who is over time immersed. Whether they're creating nonfiction or fiction, they're immersed, they're following an inner interest over time, and they're creating like a gift of time, really, to give us. Like basically they're taking years of their life and trying to constellate it into something that expresses the thing they're searching for, like, you know, some, like there's a subterranean fire, they often don't even know what's burning down there. And they're trying to bring that to the surface imperfectly, perfectly, brilliantly, sometimes half-assedly. And you work to show them, your major job is to work to show them what they've done. And, you know, it sometimes means saying really tough things to people, like, throw out this entire draft, please. Because you haven't come anywhere near what you're trying to do. And you have to be both, you have to understand both that the work isn't yours, it's not my work, but you have to give them everything you have, intellectually, emotionally, every insight you've ever had about human nature sometimes, to give them what they need to get the work done. So it sounds like it's really engrossing work. I'm the luckiest person on the planet that I've got to do this work for so many years and work with so many remarkable people.
And I think too that I love editors. I mean, I cannot imagine.
Well, you're a good one yourself, so.
Well, I learned a lot when you publish books and work with editors. You learn a lot about the process and how it's done. But honestly, I mean, people who think they don't need to be edited, they probably mostly need to be edited. It's you know, that third, I appreciate that other set of eyes who are not, I mean, they don't have they don't have skin in the game in a way. So they can really tell you how it's working and how it's not working.
In a way, your friends and family never will.
Oh, no. And, I mean, okay, I'm going to say something really bad right now. So you shut your ears if you don't want to hear a bad thing. But I worry about writing groups.
Oh.
Because, you know, writing groups, they encourage you. They pat you on the back. But sometimes they say, oh, we don't need the father, cut the father out, or oh, we need more father, you know, put him in. And but they're readers. They're speaking to you as out of opinion. They're readers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an editor, a really professional editor, they're not doing that.
No.
Not at all. So it's,
yeah. A funny distinction that's hard for people to understand. Yeah.
Can you say it better than I did?
I don't know. I think, no, I'm not sure I can. I think the best way I can say is that you're... there's a funny thing where a writer will invest their editor with a certain kind of authority. They need to trust you to tell them what they're really doing, what they're really making, are they making it? And they need your advocacy on behalf of the work. You're advocating to them on behalf of their own work sometimes. Because, you know, sometimes they think the best thing in it is absolutely the worst thing. Just, you know, because it's been so hard to figure it out, so hard to catch it on the page. You know, they're just so invested. They really, you know, or they're just suffering some kind of crisis of confidence. I worked with Richard Gwynn on a book that was published a long time ago, which was his biography of Sir John A. Macdonald, quite a contentious figure, it turns out. And it was all warts included kind of biography, but. Richard Gwynn, who I don't know whether you remember him, but he was incredibly politically astute, covered Canadian politics and social events for five decades. Yet when he wanted to write about Sir John A. because he thought we were forgetting about many of our figures that made the place what it is today. But he was so intimidated by historians. He was writing because historians didn't seem to be telling bigger stories at the time. And so he wanted to do this big story, but he was worried that they were all going to catch him out on some big flaw. So the first draft, and Richard's now long departed, but he will be the first one to also say this. The first draft was a stitched together piece of archival material, and there was no voice in it at all, no authorship in it at all, no opinion at all from one of the most opinionated men I've ever met. And so I basically had to say, Richard, you have to throw out the entire first draft, which has taken you 4 years, because you have not told any form of a story. And so you have to have this weird authority to be able to say that to somebody, or confidence, or just... But I've always found that because I advocate on behalf of the work, I usually do not get that terrible defensive, you know, thing that writers have, where they'll say, no, no, you can't touch a single word, because usually when I say something, secretly somewhere in their inner heart of hearts, they know that there's a hole there that they've fallen into. So you end up, it's like part diplomacy, part psychology, but it's also just in aid of trying to get this very difficult thing that somebody's trying to do done.
Yeah. And, you know, there are not good editors out there, too. I've been really privileged because Alan Seligman was one of my first editors, Jan Walter, yourself, Susan Renouf. I mean, I've had some really good editors, but I came very close to not having a good editor with The Convict Lover. The person who acquired the book handed the editing over to someone who had some personal prison experience, which is fine. And in his first note to me, he said, love the book. What I think you need to do here is concentrate. So I had written the whole bloody thing. And at that point, I think it was 750 pages. Oops. It ended up at 350. I was very good with the knife. But he said, I think you need to concentrate on the life story, forget all the prison history and all the prison stuff, and just tell us the story of, you know, Peggy and the prisoner. Well, I didn't even respond to him. I called the acquiring editor and I said, I would like to withdraw the book. You haven't given me any money yet, and I can't do what that editor thinks needs to be done. So, and to her credit, she said, well, I think that's one person's opinion, let me figure this out. And then she took it on, and she was a wonderful editor. But I'm glad I had worked on it for 8 years, and I knew really clearly what I wanted from the book, and it wasn't a romance, right?
Yeah.
But I guess, I'm not sure why I told that story, just that writers...
You're illustrating that there are bad editors in the world.
There are. Well, there are people who don't maybe get, you know, it. I had, obviously, in part, I hadn't done the manuscript well enough, otherwise he would never have said that, right? And the manuscript did improve a lot after that, but also, I guess, just illustrating that writers have to have a certain amount of confidence.
Oh, yeah.
In their own work and their own idea.
Oh yeah, or you're sunk as an editor. You can't edit a bag of jelly. It's very hard.
So once this sort of substantive edit is over, do you also do kind of a line edit?
I do it all, yeah. And in fact, I completely beleaguer my poor authors, and I warn them in advance that I tend to do I tend to do a substantive and a line edit at the same time. Do you guys know what a line edit is? Yeah, it's just it's actually the final, when you're looking at sentence to sentence, do the sentences all work? Substantive is the bigger ideas, and line edit is, but I find often that I find the big flaw in the work in the line.
Yeah.
Because if the lines are vague, you can feel almost like, I don't know how I do it anymore because I've been doing it for so long, but you can feel where it's almost like, the first read I do is often like, sort of, like almost like an energy read of the manuscript. I read for where I'm sleeping, I read for where I'm wide awake. I read for where it's naughty, and I find that so I do the big ideas and the line at the same time. And so I always wore them first. I was working recently with Brian Thomas Isaac on his. He's a wonderful writer from BC, whose first book launched him. He was long-listed for the Giller. His first book, he published it, I think he was 73 when he published it, and he was raised in the Okanagan Reserve, and he was out of school after grade 8. He was a bricklayer, he worked in rodeo, he worked in the oil patch, he did everything, and always he wanted to be a writer, and he wanted to create that world of the world he grew up in, reserve life, but not told through the lens of victimhood, told through the lens of... Anyway, I warned him when I didn't edit his first book. I edited Bones of a Giant, which is just out in May. And I warned him, like, Brian, you're going to see it. You're going to see the line edit like crazy and the big ideas all, so don't worry. And he said, I'll do it on the page so you're not dealing with an electronic document with lots of lines running everywhere. And I was sort of worried, and I was standing by ready for the phone call, but he loved it because he also saw that he could see more clearly where his holes were, but where his language was tangled.
Yeah.
So a lot of people work, they do big picture first, and then they do line edit, and I do it all at once, the poor people I work with.
Well, I find that too, because even on the level of grammar, I find if the grammar isn't working, it's usually because the ideas are muddled.
You know? Well, I kind of knew it from my own work because the work books I published, I knew where my own manuscripts were a mess was where I wasn't deep enough, where I hadn't thought well enough, where I was trying to put two unlike things together with a really specious linkage, because I sort of knew they went together, but I didn't know how. So those are the kind of things you look for when you're editing. You're trying to find where the thinking hasn't been done, where the feeling hasn't been done. And it's interesting. People say also, how can you edit fiction and nonfiction? They're so different. Well, no, they're not. They're with nonfiction. However, I do have to bring an ability to interrogate the real world to the process. You know, I have to fact check, think about defamation, all those kind of things. But basically, with sort of nonfiction writers, it's what of the world haven't you interrogated yet? And with fiction writers, it's what can you imagine that you haven't imagined yet? So it's same kind of questions, just slightly different frame.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even in fiction, the world has to hang together, right?
Yeah.
It has to work in a believable
and authentic
way.
Yeah, it's like I did an onstage conversation with Eric Andrew G yesterday. I didn't edit him, but he knew he did this wonderful book on the Montreal Neurological Institute, and the two men who founded it and drove it, Wilder Penfield and Bill Cohn. And he knew when he ended in his first draft that it was a bunch of facts. Like, it wasn't, like, he said, I'm a newspaper writer, so it was a bunch of, you know. And his editor worked and worked and worked to both draw out the relationship between the two men, which was the driving force of the storytelling, and also make him conscious of the narrative power. And the upshot is everything he learned then elevates in a way that makes the reader happy, you know, not slogging through because they're interested in the brain, but reading a narrative that's very powerful about how creativity happens, how scientific breakthroughs happen, how people break each other's hearts in ways that are inadvertent, how, you know, it's just, you know, so, yeah, with nonfiction, you have to be as artful, maybe sometimes even more artful, because you feel like you're dragging this big trunk of fact along with you, and can you dare to imagine something around that fact?
I think it was Janet Malcolm who said, fiction is more believable than nonfiction. right? Because it is a world that exists within itself.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas in nonfiction, the reader always knows.
But what about?
Yes, right. They always know that the world is there, and so they're never as fully immersed in nonfiction as they can be in fiction. And that presents a huge challenge for the nonfiction writer.
Yeah, it does.
Right?
Yeah. Also, just a huge layer of insecurity. Have I reported enough, dived deep enough, followed every thing to its end? I worked with an incredible American writer named Kat Bohannon on a book called Eve. And Eve is basically a 200,000-year history of the origin of female sexual characteristics.
Okay.
So, it's like looking into all the little Eves that made up every aspect of the female body, from the way hair it grows to your breasts to your
whatever.
The fact that reproduction is actually really complicated and identifying, and, you know. Anyway, so I signed it in 20... Okay. The first draft I got about 4 years after we signed this book was 350,000 words. Okay, so...
And a normal, usual book is what, like 100,000?
100,000, yeah. Because she is a magpie researcher and incredibly smart, and she was doing this multidisciplinary research that was looking into the anthropology and the evolutionary biology, but she was also applying it to our now, right? So she was looking at our now and healthcare now, and so... hugely baggy. Second draft, I actually managed to read that one and said, ooh. Second draft came down 100,000 words. Third draft came down 175,000 words. And it was still, and there were more footnotes that you could shake a stick at, because she had to keep everything that, the book is so fascinating. She's a really funny writer too, really witty and very fierce. And so you just want to read the whole book aloud to anybody in the room, because there's so many fascinating things in it. But then her substantive editor in the States basically said that all the pieces are in the right shape, but then we had to figure out how to make it lean and storytelling and powerful. Oof. That was a good 6 months of work, just going back and forth with Kat on. And so by the time the book came out, you're looking at, with Kat's years, which were 12, and my years alongside, that was a good, 15 years of effort to bring that book out. And, you know, it was thrilling. It was also, incredibly wearing, because I had to learn about stuff I had no clue how to even judge. But what I understood was that my not understanding was the flag the reader needed.
Right.
If I couldn't freaking understand it, there was no word in hell that any other person reading it would understand. So basically, one of my biggest questions with Kat was, H-U-H, huh? What? Okay. Oh, but man, it's a wonderful book, Eve.
Well, and the other book that I have heard you did a tremendous amount of work on was the Romeo and Dallaire.
Yeah.
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 Can you tell us anything about that?
You want to be sad? the Dallaire, I'm so proud of the work I've done on Dallaire. I've worked on all of his books. The first book was Shake Hands with the Devil, which was his account of the Rwanda genocide, from being the guy who thought the world had given him the job of preventing that genocide and then stopping that genocide, and feeling like he had failed utterly as a human being because he couldn't stop the genocide. And the second last book I did with him, Waiting for First Light, was an account of all... He's the only general who's ever been so public about his post-traumatic stress disorder, which has been extraordinary. So the story of Shake Hands was... I think it was 2000. He was being brought around by a literary agent to try to find an editor, a publisher who would work with his account of the genocide. Not exactly, walk in the park kind of light reading kind of situation. And Also, Romeo had a habit of, when he started talking about it, of crying. And so a lot of people thought it would be good to do the book, but a lot of people thought they couldn't withstand the fact that their author was so naked, so smart, but also so wounded, and also so emotional. And he was emotional because he literally felt like he was carrying 800,000 deaths on his back. Very egotistical of him on one level, that he thought that, that. But, you know, he was a general. So we hired, we worked with him, he hired a researcher because he had not actually managed to look in both his diaries of the conflict and the cabinet of documents about his correspondence with UN. And so he hired a researcher. He also hired a guy who had been in Rwanda with him, Brent Beardsley, to help him deal with the UN side of it. And he wanted to create a document that could be used in many of the war crimes trials that were going on, as well as to bear witness to all the deaths and to what happened, the failure of the world community to intervene in that genocide. And I'm not telling you anything that he hasn't talked about or isn't also in the name. The acknowledgments of Sheikh Hans. But 2 years into the process, his researcher, with whom he'd grown very close and who was supposed to be helping him with the first drafts of things, it turned out she had a history of depression and other issues that we, none of us, knew about, including Romeo. And he thought she was feeling stressed. He gave her a weekend off. And during her weekend off, she killed herself. Okay, so this was very terrible for all of us because she was wonderful. And it just seemed so, like, we all felt like we'd missed. She was very cleverly keeping the level of her distress from people. I don't know how she managed that, but she did. Anyway, so I then had a man who felt that Rwanda had just killed another person, basically, and who felt that he could not continue the project, that it was just impossible to do. And she also had, we weren't very far along in terms of a manuscript either, and I just knew that if I let this man not do this book, terrible things would happen. He was very publicly suicidal at the time himself. I just thought, ugh. Anyway, he would not hire another researcher, so I basically said, okay, what if I work with you? Because he knew, he felt I was his commanding officer, and I said, so what if I work with you? And I gave him the summer off, and then that September, we started to work. And it was one of the most, I think my solar plexus tensed with just the stuff you hear, where you're trying to sort out with that book, what can the reader bear, what needs to be told. And he also was, because of his PTSD, he had a hard time seeing what was actually on the page. Like, so I'd edit a chapter, he'd write a chapter, it'd be 150,000 words, I'd edit it down to maybe 30,000 words, I'd send it to him for him to review, and it would expand again, because basically he wanted to make sure that all the important points were met in every chapter, and couldn't tell that a reader would carry it, like the reader would carry the thread, so he didn't have to talk about the humanitarian response and everything. So, we staggered through, we got a draft done finally. Part of the time I moved him to Toronto, and he was working in our small boardroom because I needed him to just be close to be able to get this done. And then I realized that, oh my God, I have to send this to him now, the whole manuscript, for him to work all the way through it. And I thought, he's just going to blow it all up again because he can't. Then I thought, okay, he's a general, right? Generals are used to taking in very complicated streams of information through their ears, right? They can do the layers, they can, many streams are reported from many places. So I thought, okay, Romeo, I'm coming to Ottawa and I'm going to read the book to you. So the first